Hello, and welcome to Practical Significance, a podcast to inspire listeners with compelling stories from statistics and data science and to propel data-driven careers forward. Here are your hosts, the ASA's Director of Strategic Initiatives, Donna Lalonde, and Executive Director, Ron Wasserstein.
Welcome, everyone, to the second episode of Practical Significance. Ron and I are delighted to be able to share with you conversations that we had with four really wonderful guests. We talked with David Marker and Adrian Coles, who are co-chairing the ASA Anti-Racism Task Force. So David and Adrian will update you on the activities of the task force and share some other insights. Then we talked with Kim Sellers and Julia Sharp, who are leading the effort of the newly established Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, fondly known as JEDI Outreach Group. So stay tuned for wonderful conversation. Well, welcome, David Marker and Adrian Coles, to Practical Significance. Ron and I are really delighted to be able to talk with you about the important work of the Anti-Racism Task Force. This is a big job, chairing the task force. Why did you say yes? And maybe I'll go to Adrian first, and then David can chime in.
Well, thanks, Donna. I certainly appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and Ron today and to be on the podcast. As you've noted, you know, this is very important work that we're doing. And so we're looking forward to helping to drive some positive outcomes within our organization and also within our discipline. But really, to get to your question, you know, why did I say yes to participating in this way? I think for me, I decided long ago that I wanted to devote a significant portion of my professional energy to creating pathways and opportunities for members of BIPOC and underrepresented communities. Racism, especially covert racism, is really one of the primary obstacles to accomplishing that lifelong goal. There's a level of devotion that I have that is largely motivated by my childhood experiences. I grew up in a low-income community in a city that was the last capital of the Confederacy. So I know the effects and the feelings of systemic racism and other forms of racism firsthand. And unfortunately, I've seen, you know, many bright and intelligent members of, you know, my own community and other BIPOC communities succumb to low expectations and structural barriers, fear tactics, and, you know, other negative social forces that target us based on racial differences or ethnic differences. And I can't help but to wonder how much more we could have achieved if, you know, these persons have been exposed to a broader range of opportunities, more enlightening streams of thought, or, you know, had access to pathways to participate in the human narrative in a different way, right? So participating in this initiative was really an easy choice for me. Confronting racism head on is just the right thing to do. It provides me with an opportunity to make the kind of difference that I want to see in the world. You know, what could be a greater motivator than that? So
that's wonderful. David, would you like to share your motivations with us?
Sure. Thank you for having both of us on the podcast. My inspiration also comes from my childhood, similar to what Adrian just said. I was raised in a family that really stressed the Jewish principle of tikkun olam, the need to be an active ally to repair the world. Everyone should have the same rights and opportunities, and you can't stay silent when you see that that's not the case. My father attended the 1963 March on Washington. My godfather was the Anti-Defamation League's chief lobbyist for the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. My mother oversaw the first study of architectural barriers in D.C. And then my older brothers organized Soviet jewelry rallies. One even got arrested, chaining himself to the Russian embassy. So there was a expectation. And as I grew up, I got appointed to our county human rights commission by both Democratic and Republican county executives and co-founded an anti-apartheid group. You know, you can't expect those who have been oppressed to solely take on the burden to push for equity. They need strong allies, and that's what I try to be. And when you combine that with kind of what Dr. King called the urgency of now, that right now our profession is being used and abused in the forefront of many social policies. When you look at the fight for police reform, there is a tremendous use of statistics, whether it's in predictive policing, facial recognition, in gerrymandering, the use of big data and IT combined with statistics, voter ID laws. And just this week, I was told that child welfare programs are getting into predictive analysis as well. So there's just, this is the time when we have to step forward and try and make sure our profession is being a cause for good and not being abused.
Those stories are really helpful. Appreciate you sharing them. Donna, I'm sure you heard the same things that I did, that you and I know the reasons why the ASA presidents picked these two to lead this effort. And now you can see what a great choice it is as we hear these background stories leading into it. So we've had this task force for a few months, and it will be ongoing for a number of more months. But are there some initial thoughts or insights that you're ready to share? Maybe, David, I'll start with you first, and then we can swing over to Adrian.
Well, first of all, we have a tremendous group of about 20 statisticians, and I'm inspired by the range of activities. I don't know where we're going to end up, but we have kind of a three-part system. We're looking internally at the ASA. We're looking at how the ASA interacts with the statistical community at large. And then we're looking about how statistics interacts with the much larger world. And there's room on all three of those. Just to throw out a couple quick examples, and then I'll turn it over to Adrian. Think about the organizations that we join with to put on programs. So when we put on the joint statistical meetings, we bring in a bunch of other organizations, and we'd like them to have similar fundamental principles to us. But it doesn't really make sense to say that an organization like the Chinese International Statistical Society or the Korean one shouldn't have policies that reflect race, because their fundamental position is to, you know, increase the role for people from Korea or from China. So it's not like we can say that we won't team with anybody whose policies have some racial makeup to them. But on the other hand, you wouldn't want, if the Statistical Society of Canada said that no Blacks could be members, we wouldn't want to be joining with them. So how do we set up procedures? I'm really intrigued by how we do that. And then on the reaching out part to the general population, I mentioned some of the issues that come up, but we're also looking at what should organizations where statisticians work, what kind of responsibilities do they have in if they're working on AI programs or something like that. So the opportunity here is amazing, and we have a good group of people working on it.
Thank you, David. Adrian, what's on your mind?
Yeah, so just to follow up David's response, you know, I think it's a little early to share a lot of information that is emerging until we have an opportunity to really think through it and interpret that data and figure out what it really means. And so I will say that the first few months of our work have been primarily focused on casting vision, creating a healthy team environment where inclusivity and grace are prioritized, and getting alignment from the board on the vision and the agenda that we have for our task force. We've actually organized our workflow such that Q1 and Q2 of this year is when teams will be digging down deeper into three strategic areas, and those areas were just shared by David. And again, what we really want to determine are what are those activities that are already occurring within our organization that are helping us to be anti-racist, and where there might be some opportunities to make meaningful changes, right, to policies and practices and procedures and such. You know, where we find, you know, activities and things in place that are working well, we want to amplify those. But we also want to be very intentional about identifying where the gaps are and identifying those opportunities and laying out a roadmap or a plan to move forward that will help the organization be, you know, more anti-racist. So as David alluded to, you know, we're just excited to see where we land. We're excited to see what we discover. And it's our hope that, you know, prior to the end of this year, we'll have an opportunity to share more insights and more information about what we're finding in different forms.
David and Adrian, I might jump in and ask a follow-up. On the podcast this month, we're also talking with Kim Sellers and Julia Sharp, who are leading the efforts to form the foundation of the JEDI Outreach Group. And one of the things that talking with Kim and Julia was about how folks could get involved in the JEDI Outreach Group. So I wanted to ask you, are there ways that members of the community can contribute to the work of the task force?
So Donna, that's a great question. The task force is final. So the membership and the composition of the task force has been decided. But as we are sort of thinking about how we organize our work, you know, we've partitioned into subcommittees. And each subcommittee has different, you know, team members who are taking on leadership roles there. And we do want to make the work that is being conducted by those subcommittees accessible by other members within our organization. So if there are folks who are a member of the ASA who would like to be more involved, there are opportunities, you know, those professionals and organizational members to get involved. At this point, I don't think we've developed a good way for them to get plugged in, but it's something that we're continuously thinking about. At this time, if people are interested in getting involved, they can certainly contact myself, they can contact David, and we can help them understand what the opportunities are and help them get plugged in. But in the future, I would imagine that we'll create some type of survey or some type of interest form that people can submit to us and help figure out how they can get more involved in this work.
The one thing I would add is that we're hoping to have some kind of forum presentation discussion of, you know, interim of what we have done at the joint statistical meetings, hopefully in Seattle. And so there'll be an opportunity, I'm sure, for some input and feedback at that point as well.
Thank you both. Adrian, I have had the pleasure, as you know, of sitting in on the task force meetings and calls. And you were talking a bit about where the task force is headed and what it's working on. But it's a big project, an important project, but a big project, a challenging project. I've enjoyed watching you and David lead this. I wanted to ask you to talk to our listeners a bit about what your approach is to leading the task force.
So, yes, I think that's a good question. You know, there's certainly a lot of, you know, leadership models that one could incorporate into their leadership style or use to define the language of their leadership style. As many of you know, I am a former United States Marine. So I spent the first 8.5 years of my adult life in the Marine Corps leading and training Marines. And so there are a lot of leadership lessons that I took away from that experience. And one of the things that sticks with me the most is that the most effective leaders are agile. In that statement is a recognition of the fact that leadership is situational. So the way I may approach leadership as it relates to the anti-racism task force may be slightly different than the way I approach leadership in other spaces. But as it relates to the anti-racism task force, I try to combine multiple leadership styles in a way that is effective for our team. In particular, I try to implement or employ a leadership style that is a hybrid of a servant leadership model, a democratic leadership model, and maybe even a bit of a laissez-faire type of leadership model as well. And I think in doing so, it allows me to prioritize some key tasks. First, I think it allows me to prioritize the task of casting vision for our team, along with David's help as well. You know, we have a lot of very capable and intelligent and passionate team members who are leaders in their own rights. And so I think it's important to have a unified vision to make sure that everyone is marching towards the same reality. Another key task that this allows me to really focus on or to hone in on is creating a healthy culture. Again, there are some sensitivities around the work that we're doing. We have a lot of passionate team members. And so we want to be very intentional about creating a team culture that prioritizes grace, respect for persons, you know, inclusivity, those types of things. We want to model the type of diversity and inclusion and equity that we're trying to create within our organization. It also allows me to prioritize tasks such as creating a well-defined organizational framework to help manage our workflow. As Ron just mentioned previously, there's a lot of work to be done for our team. This is a heavy lift. And so without a well-defined organizational structure or organizational framework to manage our workflow, it'd be so easy for us to veer off on tangents and to address topics that may not help us to really drive the outcomes that we want to see at the end of our work. And lastly, I'll say that my view of myself as a servant leader prioritizes my need to support the people who have been appointed to leadership roles of our subcommittees. If there's one way that I would describe myself as a leader consistently within a hybrid framework or outside of a hybrid framework, it would be as a servant leader. So making sure that those persons who are on our teams, who are contributing their time, their talent to this work, making sure that everyone is supported and that they have the resources they need to be successful is very important to me. It's a critical function. So again, in other spaces, I may lead a little bit differently, but here for the task force, I think this hybrid model that incorporates these three leadership styles is what I believe to be most effective at this time.
Yeah, there's so much going on in the world. We can't address all of it. So Adrian and I we worked to get a consensus on, first of all, what we meant by anti-racism. What do we mean by racism? And so at our very first meeting, we had a discussion and came to the conclusion that we weren't making a distinction between race and ethnicity, that fighting anti-Hispanic activities and structures was within the realm of anti-racism. So that was important. We've been coming back to that in our meetings, having that boundary. You know, there are many other issues about LGBTQ and gender that are not in our purview, but we needed to decide what was in our purview. And the other one was timelines, that we not only have an internal timeline, Adrian mentioned about what we're doing in the first couple quarters and then the next quarter, but while we don't know what our final recommendations are going to be, we know that there's going to be different recommendations in a short-term and a long-term sphere. And I think that provides some comfort as we work through the group, that we're not trying to get everything done in a specific amount of time. So I think that's, both of those are very liberating for the work of the group.
Thank you, Adrian, and thank you, David, for those insights about leading the task force. David, I want to follow up with you in a slightly different direction. You mentioned earlier allyship, and I think a lot of listeners hearing this podcast, I know I certainly would like to have some ideas about where we should look to learn more things about the kinds of things that you are thinking about as a task force. So do you have some book or article ideas, things that you think would be worthwhile for people who just would like to know more?
Sure. I'm continuing to try and expand my knowledge. As an ally, you can appreciate and understand or try to understand what people are going through and have experienced, but that's going to be very imperfect. And getting first-person stories help tremendously to understand the impact of procedures and laws and customs that may or may not have been set up to be racist, but have had those implications. So to give a few, I suggest starting with Ibram Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist, because it very nicely points out how what appear to be colorblind solutions to racial problems are generally insufficient. That if there have been racial policies that have been successful in having their racist outcomes, then you're going to have to address that head on. You can't just say you're going to be colorblind. Then there are two books by Isabel Wilkerson. The first one, Warmth of Other Suns, talks about the great migration from the South, the Black community over the last 100 years. And then I'm currently reading her new book, Caste, which makes wonderful and scary comparisons of the caste system in India, in Nazi Germany, and in the U.S. today. I mentioned earlier about Hispanics being included in our purview of anti-racist policies. Juan Gonzalez wrote a wonderful book called Harvest of Empire. Give me a very good appreciation for the different Hispanic communities within the country. And then there are just three other books I might mention, Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates, very personal first-person telling of the story. Evicted by Matthew Desmond, takes place in Milwaukee, and it shows that while not all of our problems are by any means race-based, it underlies so much of what happens. And then lastly, Team of Rivals by Doris Kearns Goodwin, the wonderful story about Lincoln, because it shows how he evolved in his views on race. When he was a congressman and before he became president, he believed in that slavery had to be gotten rid of, but he did not believe that Blacks should serve on juries and were equals to whites. And that changed in his later years. And I think that's a really interesting lesson for us all to keep in mind.
So to that point, David, if I can just follow up, there's also one other book that I would recommend. I think all of the books you just named are wonderful, wonderful resources. There's also a book called White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo that I found to be especially eye-opening. So the author, she is a Caucasian woman who grew up poor. She went on to earn a PhD in multicultural education. And in this book, she addresses the defensive instincts or reactions by members of her community when questioned about race or made to consider their own race. She challenges the notion that racism is something that only exists within bad people. And she highlights the fact that oftentimes racism is something that's happening unconsciously through systems that have been created. And so I think that is also a wonderful resource. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt there, but I just wanted to share that title and that author as well.
Wow, David and Adrian, thanks so much for this wonderful conversation and those wonderful recommendations. And I'll just give a shout out to our listeners and encourage folks to share their recommendations with us by social media or reaching out to us by email. And we'll have a great reading list by collecting all of this. So Ron and I just really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. This has been so interesting and informative. And we look forward to maybe being able to catch up with you at the end of the work of the task force on the podcast. So thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Thank you as well for having us.
Well, Kim and Julia, I think I've shared with you that one of the greatest things about this podcast for me is that I get to have these wonderful conversations with colleagues who I admire and like so much. So jumping right in, my first question to you, Kim, is you have a busy life as a professor at Georgetown. What made you say yes to taking on leadership of the JEDI Outreach Group?
Thanks, Donna, for the very timely and appropriate question. And it's worth noting for your audience that when you and Julia first approached me about serving as the inaugural chair for JEDI, I was admittedly a bit overwhelmed by the idea, given its broad mission, which, when put to action, can be a huge undertaking. At the same time, I recognize the need for such an organization and wholeheartedly believe in its message of justice, equity, and inclusion for all, and its embracing of diversity. So thankfully, I've reached a point of seniority in my career as a full professor, so that I'm in a good space to view this project as a labor of love and a significant means to support the next generation of statisticians and data scientists.
Julia, you were part of this before it was a this. Do you want to say a little bit about how the JEDI group came to be and maybe how it came to be that you decided to give Kim a call?
Thanks, Ron. So in 2018, as part of my role on the board of directors, the president-elect, Karen Cafadar, approached me to organize and lead a diversity and inclusion task group at the time. The scope of the task group was narrowed over the course of the year. As Kim said, it's a very large mission to start a JEDI group. But the task group had a very narrow mission to develop a repository of JEDI resources in STEM disciplines and to organize a consortium of organizations to collaborate on JEDI activities. So as part of the task group, we focused on those two initiatives, and then a separate group at WSDS in 2019 began planning for a JEDI outreach group. And so that came to fruition at the board of directors meetings in 2020, where we put forward the charter for the JEDI outreach group.
Thank you so much, Julia.
And I guess I'll jump in and say, maybe to both Kim and Julia, the JEDI outreach group is very new. Could both of you maybe say a little bit about sort of what it means to be an outreach group and how people can get involved?
Sure. So first, to make sure that the audience is aware, JEDI stands for Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion. And as an outreach group, we are an organization that operates both within and outside the American Statistical Association. So this is an organization intended for all who are interested in this mission. And whether you are a statistician, data scientist, or even some measure of quantitative applied statistician or the like that has such interests. And so again, just as our mission is broad, we hope for our outreach to at least be broad as well with our membership. How can one become a member? Well, this is obviously an opportunity to get in on the ground floor, and it's quite simple, where you can join via our new website at www.datascijedi.org. So again, the website is www.datascij, so D as in dog, A-T-A, S as in Sam, C-I, Jedi, J-E-D-I.org, and click on the link to become a member. As I am the inaugural chairperson for this organization, I'll be serving as chair through 2022. And this year is really intended to be a year of infrastructure building, establishing a presence both within and outside of the ASA. I'm very thankful to my leadership team that is currently working to establish this infrastructure and assisting with this endeavor. And we look forward to this year's joint statistical meetings as an opportunity to fully engage and celebrate JEDI through sponsored programming and events. In the meantime, one way to immediately contribute already exists for those of you with an artistic eye and ability. JEDI is calling on all interested individuals to create a logo for the JEDI Outreach Group, where this is a friendly competition for participants to submit their graphic along with a brief explanation of its imagery and associated symbolism to us at info@datascijedi.org by May 1st of this year, which is the deadline. And the idea is that judges will select the top three placeholders for their respective images, and we'll have an unveiling at JSM, if not sometime before. Please be on the lookout for more details in the February through April issues of AmStat News.
And Kim, I have to admit that, you know, as a person who collects office supplies, including pens and pencils, that I just want to encourage all my fellow office supply collectors out there that no professional qualifications are required to enter this competition. So we look forward to seeing art from all of our hidden graphic artists out there. So
Agreed. Definitely. This is an opportunity to show off your artistic sides.
So Julia, maybe I'll go to you because I know that a couple of the projects that began with the diversity working group that you led are near and dear to your heart. And I wonder if you wanted to say a bit more about the repository or the consortium idea.
Yeah, thanks, Donna. The repository is, it's a work in progress still. We're hoping that it'll be a dynamic repository for people to contribute resources that have opportunities within the justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion mission. So we're thinking about grants and travel opportunities, research opportunities, internships. So we're not just limiting it to academic resources. This also includes industry resources and other opportunities that are available to students, faculty, and employees of industry and government. We're working on building that repository. You can imagine that that repository will have links and paper documents and manuscripts and things like that. So we are working on building that repository now. And also the consortium, we have reached out to two other organizations to join that initial group of the consortium with the hope that we would expand the opportunities for growth of that consortium. That consortium will collaborate together to provide activities and resources to fulfill this JEDI mission. So both of those are underway and ongoing, and I hope that we can continue to work on those throughout the JEDI outreach group as well.
It's also worth noting that we have a liaison committee as well that is serving to partner with other organizations that are likewise interested in such a mission with regard to justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion. So we are not looking solely within ourselves to accomplish this larger mission, but we are working with others as well and partnering with others.
Yes, thank you for mentioning that. I see the consortium as coming from the liaisons group from the JEDI outreach group.
Julia and Kim, these are super exciting plans, and Donna and I and many others in the ASA, I'm sure the ASA board, excited to see how things develop. I'm going to switch gears just slightly and ask for you to comment on what you see as being some of the big challenges in the area of JEDI in our profession. Both of you have been in our profession for a while. You have been in leadership positions, so you've had a chance to see the landscape. So what do you think the challenges that we face in the statistical community, data science community, are at this point in the area of JEDI?
So that's a great question, Ron. Perhaps in my mind, the biggest challenge that I see with regard to JEDI is actually the vastness of its mission. And what I mean by that is, when it's all said and done, the need to better recognize equity, diversity, and inclusion comes from many different angles. And my concern is that, of course, we in our individual experiences all come with some measure of self-advocacy. So interest in bettering the scenario or situation with which we encompass ourselves. And as such, the easy approach would be to, of course, advocate accordingly. But sometimes this risks a means of producing, if you will, some sort of rank ordered impression of what tasks are more important than others, where I take a different approach. I argue all of the interests and missions associated with JEDI are going to be important. And so I concern myself, or am mindful to take great efforts to not have this perception of, again, rank ordering or importance, because a lot of times the problem is that these issues have not received the attention that they deserve to begin with. And so by giving them that opportunity of a voice and for action is important in all respects. And so I hope to sufficiently engage and tackle all of the interests that will surely come to light as we develop as an organization.
Yeah, I'd just like to reiterate what Kim said, that JEDI has such a broad mission and scope that it's challenging to rank order anything because there are so many things that can and should be done in this area. And so I think that that's the largest challenge for JEDI outside of the outreach group, but also within the outreach group, that there's just so many opportunities and challenges that we could approach.
In the end, I just remind myself that this is a marathon. It's not a sprint. So it's just a matter of, again, having concentrated opportunities and networks with which we can continue to engage and develop actual products and action towards a goal, as opposed to potentially spinning our wheels with each one trying to accomplish their own goals individually. Hopefully, as a group, as a unit, we can actually establish true results.
So Kim and Julia, to wrap up, I'd like to get us to be a little bit future focused and follow up on your responses to that question and say, so in 5 years, when you're back on Practical Significant podcast, what do you hope that you'll be able to report about the JEDI Outreach Group? So looking to the future, what do you hope we will have accomplished?
Yeah, I think that what I see as accomplishments in 5 years are the infrastructure being built for the JEDI Outreach Group and for it to be a known entity and a major player in the STEM disciplines in terms of justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion. And by that, I mean, I'm hoping that the JEDI Outreach Group in 5 years has established its position in providing resources and being recognized as a group where resources are available in terms of justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion. I think that we've got a great start with Kim as our chair and building that infrastructure. And I think that we can have a repository at that time of resources. We can also have a large consortium that is collaborating together to work on these issues and opportunities and challenges. And beyond that, I think that there's a really large area of growth for justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion in our STEM disciplines. And I just hope that in 5 years, the JEDI Outreach Group is, from the ASA, one of the premier outlets for justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion.
I agree wholeheartedly with everything that Julia has said. It would be wonderful to see an established presence of the JEDI Outreach Group within these next 5 years and to be a well-respected organization for its efforts and accomplishments. Further, I would hope, in terms of goals for progress in this regard, I would love to see the data support the efforts of JEDI through its membership to hopefully see an even more diverse membership within the ASA. It's already fairly diverse, but I think that there's always room for improvement and activity amongst all of its members. And so it would be wonderful to see that come to the forefront. And if JEDI is one way to make that happen, I'm happy to push that initiative forward.
Thank you so much, Julia and Kim, for getting us started in this JEDI Outreach Group. I don't think there's anything more important that the ASA is doing, can be doing right now, than focusing on these kinds of initiatives. And we're really grateful that you are helping us do this work.
Yeah, just absolutely. I know that we've all had a lot of Zoom meetings over the last year, but I have to say that the meeting that we had to bring the inaugural team together was just so wonderful, right? To see all of these talented people so energized. So I actually have a great deal of confidence that both your visions will be realized in 5 years or less, actually. So thanks, Julia and Kim, for joining us. We really appreciate your time and effort today, as well as your time and effort in your labor of love for JEDI.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So in 5 years, will the JEDI OG be OG? Just thought I'd ask.
You know, I was going to say in 5 years, when people think about JEDI, they'll think more about our outreach group than Star Wars. So
There we go.
These are lofty goals indeed.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Well, thanks everyone for listening. We are so appreciative of our guests, Adrian Coles, David Marker, Kim Sellers, and Julia Sharp, for talking with us about the important work of the Anti-Racism Task Force and the exciting new JEDI Outreach Group. We also want to make sure that you all check out a recent episode of Stats and Stories podcast. Recently, Angela Saini, a British journalist, was on to talk about her new book, Superior, The Return of Race Science. And it is an excellent episode. So please make sure that you subscribe to Stats and Stories as well as Practical Significance. And now to continue the tradition, I'll turn it over to Ron for a top 10.
Thanks, Donna. Here we go from the sublime to the ridiculous in this podcast. Going from sublime to ridiculous seems like a good description of my regular role in life. Anyway, I bring to you, listeners, in honor of Valentine's Day, which is soon coming up, these are the top 10 statistical sweet nothings to whisper to your partner on Valentine's Day. So, number 10, when I first saw you, I knew all my assumptions had been violated. I would be in a paired t-test with you anytime. You complete my block design. Which was, by the way, the original quote in Jerry Maguire before they shortened that. Every algorithm clusters you and me together, baby. I've run multiple comparisons, and you are still my favorite. I am skewed in your direction. You exceeded my expectations from the first moment. Donna, I really like that one. I think it's kind of subtle. We were meant for each other with 95% confidence. The penultimate item on the list is, I would have to be double blinded not to see your beauty. And the number one statistical sweet nothing to whisper to your partner on Valentine's Day, my dear, you are significant to me at the 0.10 level. So there you have it, friends. We look forward to you joining us next month for Practical Significance.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Practical Significance, the podcast of the American Statistical Association. A new episode will be coming your way next month from AMSTAT News, the ASA's monthly membership magazine.